Hello, my name is Maria Reva. I write fiction and libretti, which are scripts for opera, and my new novel is called Endling.
Maria Reva's new novel, Endling, looks a little different than it did when she first started it. The book begins with her initial premise of three Ukrainian women on a quest to kidnap 13 bachelors who are in Ukraine to find a bride. But when Russia invaded Ukraine, both the book and her life took a decided turn. I recently spoke with Reva about her characters and how she incorporated her own life into the novel. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Maria Reva. We try to be spoiler-free here, so I'd like for you to set up Endling for us. Do you have an elevator speech, or how did you pitch it?
Right. The elevator pitch would be that I was setting out to write one premise, and it had to completely break apart when the war in Ukraine broke. Maybe I'll expand on that then.
Yeah, that would be great, because I was wondering, where did the story begin for you? Did it begin with snails, or the brides and romance tour, or the Russian invasion of Ukraine? Did it start with one of these, or were they all yurts sewn together to make a mansion of a story?
One of the inspirations for Endling was actually something that happened to my sister. And this was a conversation she had on an airplane. She was seated beside an American man, and they just got to talking. And as soon as it came out that she was born in Ukraine, and I also was born in Ukraine, the first thing this man said was, "Oh gosh, I would love a Ukrainian girl as my wife, because American women are so ambitious and aggressive." Little did he know that he was sitting beside a renowned composer, Anna Podgorna, who has accomplished a lot and was on her way to Princeton for her doctoral degree. So clearly not the kind of docile bride that he had envisioned in his mind. So after hearing about this conversation, I wondered, well, what is this perception we have here in the West, kind of the Eastern woman, right? The Slavic woman. And I guess the next logical thing for me to do was put in Ukrainian woman into English language Google to see what I would find. And depressingly, many of the search results were about how to date Ukrainian women. And many self-published books by men who were frustrated with the local dating culture and thought that they could find themselves, find bliss and love abroad, kind of in this exoticized realm. And that is how I then came across these romance tours. So these were tours that used to take place in Ukraine before the war, where men from all over the world would come in to the country on these very packed itineraries. And they were sold on this promise of finding this perfect docile bride, untainted by feminism and modernity, and that they would find her in, you know, X number of days. So I wanted to start my novel with that, focusing on 13 of these men, the unfortunate luck of being kidnapped by three women who are posing as prospective brides in these tours, but who are actually activists who are trying to burn this whole industry down to the ground.
Well, maybe we should talk about some of your characters, because one of these women is Yeva. And, you know, a couple of times in the book, when people learned her name, there was a reference to Eve, you know, the original mother. What should we know about Yeva? And also, maybe this would be a good time to define Endling.
Yes. So the term Endling means the last member of a species. So once that member dies, the species goes down with them. So that's however thousands or millions of years of genetic memory just goes poof, it disappears, which is a really heartbreaking concept. So what Yeva does, I mean, she takes part in these romance tours as a way to fund her research into snail endlings. So she's trying to save snails from the brink of extinction in Ukraine. And yeah, she's trying to take them from their environments and have them breed in her mobile lab, which is really just kind of this RV that she carts around the country. The ironic thing is that, the scientist who's trying to, make the right environment for sex is actually the least romantic person you might ever meet. And despite the many pressures of her family for her to finally settle down, get a family, stop living out of this RV, that's not what she wants to do. So in a way, she also sees herself as an endling, someone who doesn't want to have kids, and she kind of sees herself in a way as the end of the line as well.
Did you know about snails when you started her storyline, or is that new to you?
I love that question. I mean, I've always appreciated snails because I find that they're an antidote to the fast-paced, the chaos of modern life. I don't know if you've ever watched a snail for a long time, but it's kind of this meditative thing where once you look up, everything is almost in this, comical fast motion, right? So there was this article I came across about this snail named Jeremy, who was a garden snail in the UK. And he was born with this very rare mutation of his spiral turning to the left instead of the right, which made it almost impossible to breed with the rest of the population, right? Because the genitals are then placed on the other side. So then he would have to have another left whirling snail in order to have breed. So this inspired this international search. I think the BBC covered it for other left whirling snails. And there were actually two that were found. I think one was in Spain, and they were brought into the lab. And the tragedy is that actually those two other snails had a great time in the tank, if you know what I mean. And poor Jeremy still alone. So I'd read that article and I thought, wow, this is amazing, because in our media landscape, when we talk about conservation, we often focus on what is called charismatic megafauna. So pandas, koala bears, otters, so big furry animals that you can kind of cuddle with. But we often don't focus on the underdogs, like the humble snail.
Another character is Nastia, and in the audiobook, her name was pronounced Anastasia.
Yes.
And she also was part of this romance tour, but she didn't really want to date or get married either, did she?
No, she is part of the romance tour because she's trying to find her mother, actually, who disappeared. And her mother was the activist, the well-known activist who was trying to bring this whole industry down. And then she disappears. So Nastya thinks, okay, if I try to recreate this kind of activism, and if I make a huge statement, like kidnapping 13 Western would-be grooms, my mother will come back to me. Whether or not that's a good plan is for the reader to judge, but that is her plan.
And then there's Paul, or Pavlo. He was born in Ukraine but moved with his parents to Canada when he was 8 years old. And I noted this observation in the book that his bravery was untested. Can you talk about him?
Yes. So we have one of the kidnapped bachelors, right? He has actually many versions of his name in the book. So we start with the name Pasha, which is kind of the more Russified version of his name. And he immigrates to Canada as a child, and he feels like he is the failed immigrant. And that's actually, I think, a lot of what millennials often feel right now, whether or not they're immigrants, right? So how do I buy a house? How do I start a family? Everything is so expensive. I can't do the same things my parents have done. I must be a failure. So that is what he's feeling in Canada. And he thinks, okay, if I go back to Ukraine and restart my entire life, I'll get it right this time. So then he goes back and he tries to reconnect with his homeland. It's a really rough process. And once the war breaks out, that is when he has to really be tested, right? He has an idea of himself, but then how does that idea translate to action when chaos begins to reign? And I think that's a question that this book poses a lot. It's How do different minds react to cataclysm, right? So Yeva, she's probably the least functional character at the beginning of the book. She is very depressed. Her snail mission is failing. She's drinking a lot. Yet, once the war comes, she is probably the most functional character of the rest of them.
The other main character I want to talk about is you, or the fictional version of you. I mean, it's clear that you weave some of yourself or much of yourself into the novel. I'm not exactly sure how much, and I don't want to spoil how much or reveal too much, but at one point in the book you wrote, "No, these lines are not true to what happened. I need to keep fact and fiction straight, but they keep blurring together." How did you determine where fiction would end and begin and when fact would be part of it?
Right. So to give a bit of context, so the romance tour premise, the snail premise, that was what I was working on since, let's see, the year 2018. That's what I had been working on. And when Russia launched its full-scale invasion, it was a very disorienting experience to watch the place I was writing about be destroyed in real time, and my relatives having to flee their homes. So I actually gave up on the book for a while, and I couldn't keep going. I thought, what is the point of fiction when we have this collision of reality? And to write kind of the so-called invasion of Western bachelors to Ukraine when there's an actual military invasion happening. But then I realized, well, the messiness of reality, maybe that's what has to be reflected in the book as well, and all these questions I'm grappling with, right? With identity as well. What is your role as an artist in a time like this? What is your role as someone who's living abroad at a time like this? I wanted to fold all those questions into the book, into the structure. So, without giving too much away, I mean, the type of narrative is pretty conventional when you start the book, and then it derails, it breaks apart, it forms into so many new kinds of types of way of having narrative. So the book starts as fiction and it ends as nonfiction.
You know, one of the questions it seems like you were grappling with was actually on that same page. You explored the question of who has a proper claim to grief. Can you talk about that?
That was a difficult one, of course. That question, who has a proper claim to grief, also ties into who has it worse. Right. So a pattern I noticed was when I went to Ukraine in 2023 with my sister, of course, to see my relatives and also to conduct research for this novel. We noticed that when people spoke of their experience in Ukraine, there's often this caveat of, okay, it might be bad in my city, but it's not this other city, right? Somebody has it worse. So the more, we started in Western Ukraine, which was deemed by so many real estate ads as, the safest place in Ukraine. And then we progressively went east. So then we went to Kyiv. And in Kyiv, we heard, oh, Kyiv, we're not as bad as Kharkiv, right? So then we went to Kharkiv, which you can walk to Russia from Kharkiv if you take the full day. That's how close it is. But in Kharkiv, people were saying, well, it's not as bad as Kherson, right? And Kherson is where my grandfather has stayed this whole time. So it was almost this, who has a proper claim to grief? It's tied in with that question. And I think it's a self-preservation method of, maybe my situation is not as bad as the next person's situation, even though, I mean, ev everyone is struggling wherever you are in the country and, in the diaspora community. It's difficult for everybody.
I want to talk about your grandfather or the grandfather in this book. It felt like there were themes of getting grandfathers out, and it might have been from different characters, but it all revolved around the same grandfather, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Yes. So my grandfather was the only and remains the only relative who stayed in place. And his city of Kherson, it was occupied by the Russians and then liberated by Ukrainians. And it was then flooded when the Russians exploded the Kakhovka Dam. And now it's being attacked. There are drones hunting civilians. And it is a possibility that it would get occupied again. And through all of this, my grandfather stayed in place. And that's not something I understood, really. And it took me a while to accept it. And, as someone who was, you could say, uprooted as a child, right, when brought to Canada, which has largely been a positive experience, I don't have that rootedness. And he does, clearly. And it made me wonder, in order to stay in place, what stories do we need to tell ourselves, right? So do we build our own zone of safety? Do we believe, okay, if I stay in this square patch of apartment, I'll be safe, right? So there's all this kind of psychological scaffolding that has to go on, and that's something I also explore in the book.
There is a passage that I marked that this has to do with your first book that came out and was largely overshadowed by COVID, if I remember right,
Yes,
by the
yes.
pandemic. This passage says, "I'm getting calls for magazine interviews, photo shoots, radio appearances I'd only dreamed of when my book first came out. I'm trying to be grateful, but why must a country be bombed before we care about it?" Another character's response is, "The world is a whore." Can you talk about this idea that a country must be bombed before the rest of the world notices?
The world is a whore line is that is from a friend of mine when I was telling him this. That was his response, and I thought, my God, I that line has to be written down. So my first book, collection of short stories set in Ukraine, came out on March 10th, 2020, which is that is the eve of the pandemic declaration by the WHO. So the op-eds I had slated about Ukraine and about kind of the language politics, et cetera. The book tour, it was all canceled. I mean, for good reason, for safety as well. But in terms of newspaper coverage, it was definitely okay, so we're shifting the lens here. Okay, like it has to happen, right? I mean, it made sense at the time. But it was a pretty disorienting experience when all that attention came back. When Ukraine was bombed. So, yeah, that was the question I had to grapple with. Why is it? And it's not just Ukraine, it's other countries, right? As soon as there's this act of violence, we're interested, right? We want to know, at least for a little while, before we shift to the next cataclysm. Yeah.
This is a serious book, but at times I found myself laughing out loud, which I do not do when I read. I never laugh out loud. And there is a section in the book where you talk about dark humor as it relates to Ukrainians. Can you talk about that?
Yes, I think there's a very long tradition of dark humor in Ukraine as a way to cope with difficult circumstances. And I think if you can laugh about a difficult reality, in a way, you're rising above it and you're taking away its power. So since the outbreak of the war, there actually has been a lot of humor flowing out of Ukraine, a lot of memes, very sharp memes. The family friends, while they were sheltering in their basement, they were still cracking jokes to us. So I would say it's a national trait. There is a specific kind of humor I think my family has as well. So it's the way I process the world. It's the way I digest it. There is also kind of a velvet handling of the reader in a way with humor. So if you can make the reader comfortable through humor, they will more easily absorb the really dark stuff as well. That's what I find.
I have a couple of audiobook specific questions because our listeners who have been listening a while know that I listen to a book as I read it simultaneously. In the audiobook, before the epigraph and the prologue, you recorded a little note. You said that in the chapters that you read, your pronunciation of Ukrainian place names and terms isn't always consistent. And this quote you said, "This reflects the blend of languages my family speaks here in Canada, and it felt more honest to keep it that way." So talk to me about this, and also, Do readers of the physical version miss out on anything from the audio version?
So the reason I felt the need to write that note or speak that note for the audio version is I find that in the Western coverage of Ukrainian language politics, there is often this black and white perception that the language you speak in Ukraine is your political affiliation. So if you speak Russian in Ukraine, that means you are pro-Russian, pro-Putin. If you are speaking Ukrainian, that means you are on the Ukrainian side. And that does not reflect reality. Where my grandfather is, it's a very heavily Russified city because also, you know, basically the more east you go in Ukraine, the more Russified it is because of the longstanding history of Russian suppression of the Ukrainian language. So there is this particular blend of Russian with some Ukrainian in those eastern parts. And again, it's not a representative of political affiliation, national affiliation. So the language that my family speaks, you know, in Ukraine and also, you know, in Canada, it's a blend of so many histories. And I wanted to be truthful to that. That it felt more authentic to me to bring my own specific language and pronunciation blend to the audiobook. As to your question, what do readers miss out on, you know, if they're reading the book rather than listening to the audiobook? That's a wonderful question. I haven't thought about that actually. Perhaps what they miss out on is the blend of different narrators in the audiobook, because we have three narrators who I think that captures the kind of kaleidoscope aspect of the book, where you have so many different perspectives weaving in and out. To actually hear that physically through different voices, I think that would be a very different effect. I'm also a narrator in this book. So I narrate the chapters that are kind of the metafictional chapters where the fourth wall breaks down and I speak, you know, I become the character, you know, the author, and I, you know, I break the book apart in a way. All the things I'm grappling with as I'm writing it. I don't know if this is a plus or minus, but I mean, the listener will hear the emotion in my voice as I'm reading the audiobook. Something very interesting happened to me is that when I was writing the book, I had a certain emotional, psychological distance from the material. I think in order to write it, I had to keep a certain distance. In order to do the research I had to do, I couldn't fall apart over it. However, when I started doing the audiobook narration, and as I was practicing for it, all of that emotion came out. I think there was a lot that had to still be processed that had not been. So, you know, by the time I was doing the recording in the studio, I mean, I had started to process it. You know, I was able to read it out loud, but there are some parts where I choke up. And again, I don't know exactly what the effect will be on the listener, but that's not something you get from the purely written version of the book.
Well, and those who read the physical book, they get to see some line drawings. They get to see, you know, you talked about the different forms that some of your chapters took. I mean, some are letters, some are interviews, and there is something to being able to, like, see that on the page rather than just listen as well. So I do think that there are pluses and minuses for either way, or you can do it both ways like I do.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of typographical play in the book. So the way words are arranged, the way the kind of the, there's a part where they try to condense a really chaotic conversation, the three characters into a, yeah, minutes. Like meeting minutes. So that's the opening minutes of the war, when there's this huge panic and these three women who have these 13 bachelors in their trailer are like, what do we do right now? And the only way to kind of contain the chaos within the page was to try to write it as meeting minutes. So yeah, so you see that on the physical version of the book.
That was the first time I laughed out loud when she said, this isn't a committee. And then she served bad coffee and says, okay, now it's a committee.
Yes, we've all had bad coffee in committee meetings. Yes.
This is another audiobook question, because I'm curious about how printed books differ from their audio versions as far as the text that is in it. Because I do listen and I read at the same time, and this is also stemming from a project I'm doing from school. I'm comparing the galley of Marlon James, a Brief History of Seven Killings, to the final version and trying to figure out what changes he made from the galley, which is not the final form. But I read the final form and some of the audio was different. So how do you make those decisions? Like, I mean, it wasn't a lot, but every once in a while I'd say, oh, well, those words weren't in the audiobook. I wonder what happened there. Because they're both technically finished versions, right?
Yeah, it's fascinating. So when I was doing the final edits for this book, and I, you know, was working with really wonderful copy editors, and some of the comments they made were, oh, this word rhymes with that word in this sentence. Is this intentional? Do we want to take that out? And at first I was like, why does it matter if that word rhymes with that word? You know? But then as I was reading the audiobook chapters, I realized, oh, this is distracting. Okay, we do need to change that word. That should not rhyme with that word because that is not my intention. So stuff that will take the listener out of the book, that's stuff you want to prune out. I also noticed sentences that are really complex with multiple clauses, I simplified some of those. Yeah, a few of those. I had to do that again so that things are a little bit more streamlined. I found it actually a similar process to working for opera, because I write script for opera. And if you have a really complex clause-ridden bit of text, it'll take forever for the singer to get through it. And by the time they get to the end, you've forgotten what the beginning was. I mean, of course, you know, an audiobook, it's not to that extent, of course, but there is a little bit of an element of, okay, how do we get to the raw emotion of this paragraph, this sentence faster, make it more immediate.
You live in Canada, you were born in Ukraine, and both have been attacked by Donald Trump of late. How do you process Donald Trump's rhetoric about Canada becoming the 51st state, given what has happened in Ukraine?
It's been very difficult. The kind of rhetoric we're hearing from Trump in regards to Canada, there's a lot of very disturbing similarities to how Putin talked about Ukraine prior to the invasion. For example, we're brothers. We speak the same language. The border is artificial. It's illegitimate. And we're going to protect you, right? That's how Donald Trump has been talking about Canada. We're going to protect you from China and Russia. And I'm not sure how seriously this rhetoric is being taken in the United States, but in Canada, I think it is being taken quite seriously. And in my book, there are some references to, you know, the history between the US and Canada and kind of, you know, the posturing, right? Because this is not the first time we've had this kind of posturing in our history between the two nations. So there were some kind of offhand jokes in my book about that. But then now that it's actually coming out, and now with the actual rhetoric that's happening, those don't seem as packed in history anymore. They seem a lot more relevant and contemporary. So it has not been an easy experience by far. It's really led to this this feeling of where is safety? Where are we safe? Yeah.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from the book?
My hope is that readers will take away hope from this book. It deals with a lot of dark and difficult material, but there's also humor in it, and there's also hope in the most unexpected places. There is this dramatic moment when Yeva finds out that there has been this other snail located actually in the heart of the war zone, this other snail that can hold the promise to that species, because Yeva has one snail of that species, and now there's this possibility of rescuing another of the species. And I heard from a reader who said that was actually the part where she cried in the book, that it was actually that ray of almost impossible hope that you can find in the least expected places. And I would really like my book to communicate that there is hope.
Well, the book is Endling. Maria Reva, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Maria Reva, author of the book Endling, which was published by Doubleday. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.